Got a good one today with Noah Eagle, broadcaster for the NBA on NBC. Feels really good to say that. NBA on NBC. Got Noah Eagle on talking about college basketball, March Madness, everything that happened this past weekend. And we also recapped what was a very interesting NBA weekend as well. That's coming up next. Welcome back to another episode of the Kevin O'Connor Show. I have a very special guest today, Noah Eagle. Noah, come on in. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, KOC. I feel like already I have these warm feelings from the warm colors of the background of your show, the yellow, orange, red. It just gives me positive vibes. So off to a great start.
Appreciate it, man. And I'm looking more like the animated logo. I got a clean shave, a better haircut. I was scruffy last week, so I'm looking more like my animated self now.
You look good, man. You look fully manscaped. I don't know how deep you actually go with that, but it's probably for the best if we avoid that answer altogether. So I'm going to stick with just well-groomed up top.
You look great yourself, Noah. Yeah, we'll keep it there. Today we're going to be talking about March Madness later. You've been covering college games this season, and next year you're going to be doing games for NBC, play-by-play announcing. So I want to start out with NBA with you because it was a crazy weekend. The Phoenix Suns, I got to start out saying rest in peace to the Suns. Their season is done. Noah, they lost last week by 30 points to the Celtics without Tatum, lost by 15 points to the Wolves, and then they lost by 39 points to the Rockets on Sunday, gave up 148 points, and KD sprained his ankle. It's done. It's over, Noah.
Yeah, it's not a great state of affairs right now in Phoenix, despite the fact that your colors do resemble the sun a little bit. I would that there was so much expectation coming into this season, and for myself included, outside of just Mike Boonholzer, but his entire staff, whether it's Brent Berry and Mike Hopkins, guys who have just extensive NBA lifetime experience in basketball, in particular, lifetime experience. And then it was also, hey, you've got this group coming in, and they got off to such a great start early this season with KD healthy and with Beal kind of accepting it, it felt like his role, and Booker obviously being Booker. The concern was always going to be, for me at least, defensively. And I think that's what's really shown its head. KD goes down, their offense stalls, he comes back, and their defense has never recovered. And if you're not going to play defense at a high enough level in this current iteration of the NBA, you mentioned the lopsided scores over these last couple games, that's what happens when you play against good teams, when you play against young teams like a Houston that can get up and down the floor. They just don't have answers on that side of the ball. Now, yes, I would say it's going to be difficult, and to your point, it's likely going to be a done season and a lost season, but at the same time, they have nothing to just pack it in for, and it's not just this season, but that's moving forward. I've seen this up close, whether it was with the Brooklyn Nets growing up, currently working with the Brooklyn Nets, where you don't have picks and you've got to get creative, and so I think a lot of people look at the situation in Phoenix moving forward and say it's bleak. I actually somewhat disagree because they do have assets, and if they decided, and I don't know what Matt Ishbia wants to do, but if they do decide to blow it up, you can still get somewhat of value. You're not going to get the same value you traded away for Kevin Durant, but you can get legitimate value coming in for Kevin Durant. I'm not saying they're going to give Booker away, but you could get a lot of value for Devin Booker. I don't think anybody is just going to take Beal and feel good about giving legit assets away for him. But you've got some young pieces in there. They had a nice find with Ryan Dunn this year, who's shown flashes of being a legit NBA rotation guy.
Iguodaro, too. They have very good off the bench.
No doubt. Oso's been really good for them. So they do have some semblance of something moving forward. And I think that everybody says, well, they don't have any picks. They don't control their own picks. The best thing I saw the Brooklyn Nets do, especially going back to the 18-19 season and now really in this current iteration of their rebuild, is take on bad contracts, which I think the Suns would eventually be willing to do as they clear some space, with attached assets. So for the Nets, D'Angelo Russell comes in the trade with Brook Lopez because they took on the contract of Timofey Mozgov. Now D'Angelo Russell becomes an all-star. It completely changes what their team looks like moving forward. And then they had to take some risks. So Caris LeVert was an injury risk coming into the draft. They still took him into the 20s because they felt the talent was there. And if he could stay on the court, he would be a big time player. I think that that's kind of where we're heading for Phoenix right now. But at the end of the day, it's going to be hinging on what Kevin Durant wants. And if Kevin Durant wants to be there, then he'll be there and they're going to keep trying.
I mean, look, you say it might not be as bleak as some people think, but I mean, do you want to be the Nets?
Oh, come on, man. Come on. Do you want to be the Nets? Drop that. We're 5 minutes in.
Do you want to be the Nets? I don't know. I'm not so sure you want to be the Nets right now if you're the Phoenix Suns a couple years after making the finals. After making these trades with the hopes of being contenders, maybe you do want to be the Nets if you're a rebuilding team. You feel good. You got picks. You have versatility. You got cap space. But if you're the Suns coming from what you came from, you don't want to be the Brooklyn Nets. And that's what makes this situation so disastrous, because they were in the freaking finals. And they had a team that fans loved. People loved the Phoenix Suns. The Suns fans were, like, of all the fan bases, the people I know in Phoenix were probably among the happiest fans, with Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson and DeAndre Ayton and around Devin Booker, him growing into a superstar with veterans mixed in. They were in a great position. And then it was eliminated for a team that, like, on paper should have been better, but isn't. And you mentioned their defense is the reason why they've been horrible, and that's true. But their offense also has just been 10th in offensive rating this year. They're only 10th. Like, they're expected to be an elite offense, number one, number two in the NBA, up there with Cleveland, Boston, Denver, OKC, these teams, but they're not. And so, like, their offense is underwhelmed. It plays slow. Their defense is absolutely horrific. And you're right. Like, even without KD, this team, I would think, you know, like, if they have any heart at all, the last seven games are going to be fighting like hell. But at the same time, like, this team has shown me, like, they're facing their last seven games, Noah, they're facing teams with a 60% winning percentage. So that's like the equivalent of a 49-50 win team. And they're a game and a half back. Yeah. They've shown no ability to fight. And I just don't trust that this team is going to put any heart out there. I think they're going to lay down and die, is my expectation. Like, they already have this past week.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the winning percentage thing. I look at this schedule here, and I say, all right, Milwaukee is not necessarily in a great place right now either. Boston essentially is locked into the 2 seed in the Eastern Conference, and at what point do they start saying, we're going to slow it down and ramp up for the playoffs and kind of take our time? The Knicks right now, it'll hinge on Jalen Brunson being healthy. But that's a difficult game. Golden State's locked in a battle, so they need to be great.
Yeah, I mean, look, the schedule, you can talk about, you know, they might win some of these games. They might have the ability to steal some. But I just think this team is dead. And that's why, like you said, it's all about, what are they going to do this summer? Are they going to trade KD? Are they going to get fair value back for him at his age in his late 30s with only 1 year remaining on his contract? Is he going to be able to leverage his way toward the team he wants, possibly limiting the return for Phoenix? A lot of questions there. To me, the only question with the Suns this summer is, does Devin Booker ask out here? Does another team make an offer so strong that the Suns, they say yes, like, regardless of Devin Booker's wishes. That's a possibility as well. And that's where that trade they made, trading their, I think, 2031 first round pick at the deadline for 3 first round picks. Everybody said that deal was about loading up and trying to get assets this year. I think that deal was actually more about setting themselves up for more versatility moving forward. Because if they were to trade KD, if they were to trade Devin Booker, they'd have those 3 firsts. They could get other picks in other years, and they might not have their own picks unless they do a deal coincidentally with the Rockets after getting blasted by them on Sunday. But they'd have a lot of picks, and so, like, it's not all bleak for Phoenix, but, man, it's not great.
So there's 2 things just to respond to what you just said. One, if you had said 2 years ago that there was even a possibility of trading Devin Booker, if someone told you that 2 years ago, you would have been just beside yourself, confused, worried, concerned about what was happening in Phoenix to lead to that. Because 2 years ago, he was probably one of the most untouchable pieces in the NBA. He had built himself into that, and rightfully so. And even coming off his Olympic performance, just seeing that up close, he was probably the biggest X factor on that U.S. team this year. He was the one guy who sacrificed as much as anybody who played major minutes. And he was awesome defensively. I mean, he took on the challenge of defending the best player on the opposing team every single game. And so for a guy who clearly has been willing to do all the winning type of plays to then within this time be potentially on the move would be shocking. The second thing I'll say, just to go back to your earlier point, that team that made the finals was beloved. I was with the Clippers when they played them in the Western Conference Finals, and I got to be around the Phoenix and Four guy and, you know, all of those crazy fans in what was Talking Stick Resort Arena or whatever it was at the time. And they were loud, they were into it, and they loved that group because of the grit that they provided. But let me just remind people how that group was built. Let's go back to the bubble year. That was a team that won, I think, 34 games, and the last eight were all in the bubble. They went 8-0 on that bubble run. And that was when Devin Booker was starting to come into his own as a bona fide superstar. And DeAndre Ayton starting to figure it out, game slowing down a little bit. Mikal Bridges and Cam Johnson are becoming legit factors. And Jay Crowder becomes a guy eventually for them who really helped build their identity. So they had that core built. And then they went out and got CP3. And that, to me, is still how you build a team in a market like Phoenix. Because, look, I do think people would go to Phoenix. I do think that it can be a free agent destination. But it's not L.A. It's not Miami, in theory, which isn't really a destination anymore. It's not New York. It's still not one of those top-tier places that I think free agents think to go to, or even a Dallas or Houston now with attack stuff. So I look at Phoenix and I say, if you're going to build it, and you want to go back to what that team was, you have to build the foundation of that first and then go out and hunt the stars. And I think that it's so easy to get caught up in this star hunting mentality, which is what they did. They go out and get KD, they go out and get Beal, and they say this is going to work. I think it's easier said than done. And you can look at Oklahoma City, and you can look at Houston, and you can look at Memphis and all these homegrown teams that are very much in playoff and championship hunts that just don't do it that way. And I still think that's the best way to go about it.
Well, one of the teams that might follow that formula you're talking about is the Detroit Pistons. The Pistons, mm-hmm. They are one of those teams where they have this young, you know, roster that's starting to really figure things out this season. They're having an awesome year. They're going to be in the playoffs. They've won 42 games so far. But then on Sunday, what we're going to be talking about right here, the bad boy Pistons. They might be back, Noah. With the Minnesota Timberwolves, with five players and two coaches ejected, Isaiah Stewart, Ron Hall, and Marcus Sasser on the Pistons side with their head coach, J.B. Bickerstaff. And then on Minnesota, Naz Reid and Dante DiVincenzo with Wolves assistant, catch this, Pablo Prigioni. People ejected Pablo Prigioni. Whoa, what a throwback name there, huh?
Yeah, well, I saw a tweet. I don't even know what the app is, but you always see the screenshots when something happens during an NBA or an NFL game or something where it's showing you the play-by-play, and I guess people can comment on each play. And somebody commented under Pablo Prigioni, and this just made me feel old. I know that there are times you probably feel the same on Twitter at this point, but there was a comment that said, "Is he a player? Who is that?" And I'm like, oh, come on, man. That's a legend right there. That was one of the oldest rookies. God. Maybe still the oldest rookie of all time, I think, right? Wasn't he 37 when he came into the NBA and had like three awesome years in the NBA? I love Pablo Prigioni. But the part of this brawl that was my favorite by far, and I'd love to know your take on this. If you watch the brawl, obviously Holland and DiVincenzo get tangled up and they get spilled out into the front row, which is – also, can you imagine getting awesome seats baseline and then immediately getting crushed by like eight massive NBA players, including Naz running hard from the back, and then Isaiah Stewart coming on the other direction? That was crazy. But the part that got me was if you watch the outskirts of it, slowly but surely, Alex Rodriguez just starts creeping in. And I want to make sure here, Alex Rodriguez starts creeping in to the entire brawl, which my take was, how many NBA owners are actually going to get involved with their team on that level? I started doing it in my head and thinking about it in my head. You've got guys like Steve Ballmer, who's going to be willing to, I think, get in there and get real nitty gritty with his team and legitimately get physical for his team. I think you've got guys like Josiah is probably underrated in that sense. And then you've got others where you just know. I don't think that Patrick Dumont is getting up and is squaring up for the Dallas Mavericks at this point. So it was a fascinating look into what the Minnesota Timberwolves are about. It obviously sparked them for the game. But I'm with you. I love this from the Detroit Pistons. And I got to see them up close a couple months ago, about a week and a half. What was it, a month and a half ago, where you see it. Like, this is what they embody, and this is what fuels them. And it really starts with your best player. If your best player, and for both these teams, I think you can say that, is about that action, which Cade Cunningham is, and I know he didn't play last night in this. Anthony Edwards is certainly about that action. When that's the case, it trickles down to everybody else. And I think Detroit has just built this gritty group that's willing to go to battle, literally and figuratively, for each other.
Another name to put on that owner list getting in the mix. How about Matt Ishbia from the Suns? Remember when Jokic pushed him?
For real.
That's another one.
He legit was about it.
No doubt. He's right there. I think it was like Okogie, I think, was like kind of on the sideline, and Ishbia kind of stood up and went towards him. And Jokic is boom, forearm.
For sure. Like, Cuban was fully, he was still there in Dallas and something's going down, he was up. He was there. He was active.
Yeah.
But you just know that I'm trying to think the number. I think it's probably 10 to 12 that I feel good not only being in there, but actually holding their own. Alex Rodriguez is probably number one in terms of holding his own. If he actually got into a scrum, somebody who's got legit experience of battling with professional athletes. So let her rip. Go ahead, A-Rod. We love it.
Yeah, A-Rod, I mean, what is he? 6'3", 6'4"? He's still in great shape. I mean, A-Rod definitely in the mix until LeBron James is an owner in some amount of years. A-Rod's probably top on the list for owners that can hold their own.
Sure. MJ would have been there, right? Michael Jordan, yes, of course. Still in Charlotte, would have been at the top and clearly would not have backed down from anybody or anything. I still love those stories of MJ at 50 years old, 55, getting in at Charlotte practice and somehow, you know, busting a lot of his players out on the court. That's always still my favorite stuff. I love any of those legendary stories, and who knows how true or what level of truth comes with that, but a lot of them say it, and so I'll stick with it. I would love to hear if A-Rod's got legit skills, though, in terms of basketball, because we know that he's going to fight for the players. Clearly, he'll get up, suit and all. I think he unbuttoned the button. It was like Superman coming out of the phone booth for him with his jacket, but I don't know what about his actual basketball skill. I would love to see him on the court.
I would love to see that as well. I just every time we talk about A-Rod, I can't get the image out of my head of him just slapping the ball out of Arroyo's hand while running down the first baseline. such a cheap move. What a loser move.
Oh, sorry. I forgot that this is a Boston friendly podcast. Yeah. I got to make sure that I'm ready with all of the,
Yankees fan? New York
sports. I am not a Yankees fan, so I can at least help you out there.
Okay. Mets?
Yeah, my dad's from Queens.
Okay. But you're allowed back.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you heard Mets and you're like, you're banished, then you would have just been an a-hole, bro. That's just a bad move. That's not even a Boston thing to do. That's just being a bad guy.
I mean, what reason would I have to say that? That'd be so horrible of me to do that. Yeah. Minnesota's been awesome as of late. They've really figured things out. Detroit, still a super fun story. But I think one thing I want to note from that whole scrum, it's a shame that anytime Isaiah Stewart is in the news, it's for these moments. Because he has been so effing awesome this year for Detroit. He's moved to a bench role and he's playing the best defense of his life. He's been versatile. He's brought energy. He's been hard nosed and he's accepted this role playing off the bench when he's been a starter in recent years, and he's completely embraced it. And I respect that about him, because a lot of guys, they'd sulk and be unhappy, but Isaiah Stewart has embraced that in the name of winning. And it's just too bad that it feels like anytime we talk about Isaiah Stewart, it's in the context of Isaiah Stewart fighting again. But he's been awesome this year for Detroit.
Yeah, look, I do also think that is partially his role. I mean, we've seen this through the history of the NBA, where guys, not just the energy and hustle and physicality in the game, But there is something about being an enforcer. And I do think that it does provide some level of value to his team. And it's clearly not just him. We talked about Cade and his willingness to kind of get in the middle of things. I think Ron Holland now has been involved with a couple of these altercations dating back to the beginning of the season. And Malik Beasley is kind of the king of egging things on. And if you heard Michael Brady on the Wolves broadcast talking about the fight, he had mentioned, and I know the players had mentioned after the fact, that this had been boiling over for the previous couple possessions. It felt like this had been several minutes. And so even for Isaiah Stewart, which as you see here, he gets a nice little hand to the midsection of Dante DiVincenzo. Again, the dude in the sweater vest next to Dante had no idea his night was going to end this way. But I do think for Isaiah Stewart, it is something that he takes pride in to a certain degree. He does not care what people think of him. And I do think that's important, by the way, for his team and for how he can continue to build his NBA career. I'm not saying I condone it all the time, but I think within reason, it can be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And you know, you say you don't necessarily condone it, but I'm sure you'd love to announce a little brawl at some point.
That'd be fun. And that's the I think everybody remembers the Malice at the Palace. All I think about every time is, man, Mike Breen really stayed under control the entire time during the Malice at the Palace. Really good on him, you know? Because all I think about as I frame it for myself is, how would I have done that? If Ron Artest went into the stands of a game that I did, what would I have said? How would I have handled that? So, yeah, I think you want to just be around anything that's interesting. And so for me, I'm not condoning it. Again, I'm not condoning it. But if I happen to be there for one of those, I'll see if I can keep myself the right way and whatever it might be.
Have you narrated the Malice in the Palace like on mute on YouTube? And how would I do it?
Yeah, yeah. Or just the imaginary version as I'm shooting in the driveway as a kid. And I'm like, oh, they're storming Eagle. Oh, he dodges two punches. Eagle is a maniac. He's knocked out four. Unbelievable. Yeah, nobody thought that this young man had packing a punch in his arsenal. But his bag is deeper than they thought. 100%. Yeah, you have to. You've got to be prepared, man. Oh, haven't you heard visualization is the most important thing in success? So yeah, you bet.
How would you narrate if Russell Westbrook came after me?
Oh,
I'm just
boy.
Sitting on my yeah. laptop, on my laptop, and Russ comes over and says, I've heard just the things you've said about me. You call me Westbrook.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, Westbrook comes over and rightfully he accosts Kevin O'Connor. Kevin accosted real early in this game. Yeah, no, Russ, listen, I will say I was around Russ for half a year at the end of my tenure with the Clippers when he got signed there. And I was there when he literally confronted a fan in the middle of a playoff game at halftime. It was in Phoenix. And for whatever reason, he took a route through the club area, the club access underneath, and some fan, I think, called him Westbrook, and he was ready to square up with him, I think. It was some weird decision for Russ to go out there and try to essentially go after this fan. Instead, what he did was finally take a breath, realize what he was doing. He took a step back, kind of went around, but I think he might have said, I'll see you afterward. I'm not positive. However, if it was Russ versus KOC, I would love it. Oh, that'd be pay-per-view level stuff right there for the two of you. So yeah, I'd be all in. I don't know how exactly I would get to around it, but I would just make sure I'm describing everything exactly how I see it.
Let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I'll get buried.
That would be best.
I won't be ready to throw like Stephen A. claims with LeBron James, whatever he says. But as Stephen A. said, you'd have no shot against 6'8", freakish athlete LeBron James or Russell Westbrook. But let's move on to some news about the Memphis Grizzlies. After recording my podcast on Friday, Taylor Jenkins was shockingly fired by the Memphis Grizzlies with, at the time, 9 games to go in the season. They've hired Tuomas Esola, their interim head coach. But the reason why they fire Jenkins, to me, I understand the timing is weird here, Noah, but they've been bottom 10 in defensive rating since Christmas. The last time they beat a team that's over 500 right now was February 2nd when they beat the Bucks. They're 0-10 since then against teams that are over 500 with an average loss of 14 points. So for Memphis, they've been horrific against the teams that you need to beat. Their defense has fallen off. Their offense has started out the year great, but it's really struggled as of late. It seems to me that Taylor Jenkins completely lost that locker room. He lost the voice. He lost Ja Morant. And for Memphis to have any shot of making something of this season, it was on the verge of being a complete lost season, to have any shot of making something of it, they had to make this change. And I kind of respect the ownership and front office for doing what they had to do right now rather than waiting like I think most teams would do.
Yeah, I think as you kind of uncover a lot of it, and if you were following Memphis for most of the season, the fact that he was let go is not the surprise. To your point, it was when it happened. And the idea that you would fire a coach who's fourth in the West with 9 games remaining in the regular season is just not common. I don't think you've ever really heard of anything like that. But this has been a season of things happening that we've never seen or heard, like Luka Doncic and Anthony Davis getting traded in the middle of the season for one another, which I don't think anybody would have ever predicted in 1,000,000,000 years. And so the fact that this happened now, while surprising, makes a little bit more sense to your point when you look at the numbers. And then, obviously, hindsight is 2020, but the fact of the matter is Ja Morant had missed 6 consecutive games, and then Taylor Jenkins gets let go, and oh wow, Ja Morant's back on the court. And so, yeah, you could say that, again, from the outside looking in, and I don't have enough information on the inside, but from the outside looking in, he maybe had lost the locker room. Now, I also think Taylor Jenkins is going to be just fine. And the one area or the one place that I would be curious with him potentially going to after this season would be San Antonio. He's got ties there. He started there as an intern. He was their G League coach. He knows the system. He and Pop have a very close relationship. And if they don't think Mitch Johnson is their answer long term after Greg Popovich, I think Taylor Jenkins could end up being there. You see, the stats tell a lot of the story. He was an excellent coach. He was a guy who many years was considered one of the Coach of the Year candidates. I think you ask coaches around the NBA what they think of Taylor Jenkins, and they're very high on what he is as a head coach in the NBA. And so I'm not concerned about him and his future. As for Memphis, they also had to act right now. And we see how fickle things are in the NBA, how quickly things can change in the NBA with star players and star players wanting to move and star players saying, you know what, I don't like this small market anymore. Let me take a different approach to my career. And so while you've got Ja Morant and you've got Jaren Jackson Jr. and you've got Desmond Bane and you've got this core around them, you've got to try to capitalize as much as you can. And so to your point, there's no real idea or at least merit behind the idea of keeping a coach that just doesn't have the ears of everybody in that locker room.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. They basically changed their entire coaching staff last summer. And right, you would think that if they wanted to fire Taylor Jenkins, they would have done it then. But I think there's still, as you said, a trust and, hey, let's try to make this work with him because he's been a good coach. I don't think he's a bad coach by any means. I think he's going to get another head coaching gig somewhere, whether it's next season or at some point in the future. He's got a lot of talent as a coach. But for Memphis, like sometimes it just runs out. You know, it just that doesn't work anymore. And the interesting thing for this season is their offense started out basically top 5 the entire season after remaking their offense. They were playing with like an outlier level of handoffs and pick and rolls in terms of not using them. They were just cutting and moving off ball and playing in space. It was a very different style of play that was driven by Noah LaRoche, their assistant coach, who was also fired. Noah LaRoche and Patrick St. Andrews were two assistants on that staff who were fired. My understanding is that LaRoche was the driving force behind that offensive innovation in their system this season. But Isalo, who is now the interim head coach, he was initially hired to be the guy who installed the offense, who was hired to be the offensive coordinator, but Jenkins kind of gave it to LaRoche. So now Isalo gets that head coaching opportunity to close the season. It seems like they're going in the direction that they wanted to go in the first place, and he's a very pick and roll heavy guy. That's always been the way he coached. As it says on screen, he was the head coach of Paris Basketball in 2024, won the Euro Cup and Euro Cup Coach of the Year. He's a very pick and roll heavy guy, and you would think for Ja Morant, a team with him that just drafted Zach Edey as a big bruising screener and roller type, you would think it'd be pick and roll heavy. Instead, they basically chopped Ja's pick and rolls in half. He was at 35 per game basically his entire career and went to 16, 17 per game at times this season. So they want to get back to more pick and roll. Even though the offense worked, I think there's a belief internally that, hey, this is regular season stuff, but like we're going to have to run pick and roll in the playoffs. And that's what we got Isalo for. So let's get back to this. The thing is there's just not enough time this year. Like there's just not enough time remaining in the season to install all that you want to install. So for Memphis Noah, I think, you know, I said to Vernal last week when I had him on my podcast, I said to him, I think the Grizzlies are going to miss the playoffs. I'm not so sure they'll actually miss the playoffs with this change, which I'm sure will spark, you know, something good for this team. But with that said, they're only a game and a half up on Minnesota for the seventh seed. Minnesota's been freaking awesome. They're only two games up on the Clippers right now. They could still easily fall to the play-in. And with Dallas having AD back at this point as the 9 or 10 seed, and, you know, I could see Memphis losing two in the play-in if they end up falling there. So I still think Memphis could miss the playoffs entirely despite this move. But this is a spark that they needed. They needed the spark.
Yeah, I know that the Grizzlies fans were thrilled with the take once you gave it. I saw a lot of the vitriol on social media, which I know you don't care about, which is what makes you you. Oh. And I respect that about you, by the way. But I will say the pick and roll thing is spot on. And Zach Edey, I saw a lot of at Purdue last year. Zach Edey, to me, at his peak, I don't know if he'll ever get to this level, but he's a 7'4" Ivica Zubats. He could be what Ivica Zubats is with more development, which I think is there. And I think a lot of people say, well, he's so old. Well, look, Ivica Zubats is 28 years old now, and look at what he's developed into this year. He's one of the best centers in the NBA. He's leading the league in rebounding. He's averaging, 16.5 and 12.5 or something like that on a really good team. I'm not saying Zach Edey's ever going to average those numbers, but he moves like him. He has hands like him. And I think if he can develop his post moves a little bit more, he could be similar to him, but especially in the pick and roll. I think he has that ceiling to him of being a bigger version. And so when you have that piece and you've got Ja Morant and you've got Jaren Jackson Jr. and you've got the proper shooters around them and you've got everything else that can provide the depth needed for Memphis, there's no reason they shouldn't be one of the best teams in the league. And I think coming into the season, I thought they had a legitimate chance of winning the Western Conference because of everything that they already had and because they had a healthy Ja Morant coming back, who was probably going to be motivated. And we obviously have seen what JJJ has done. And then you've got the Edey factor. So to your point, if they can get the pick and roll thing right, you've got Ja, who's probably the most dangerous pick and roll player in the NBA, or at least one of them with his speed and skill set. They're going to be as dangerous as any team, but I'm with you. It's just not, it's a little too late, this season to legitimately make that run.
Last thing I want to talk about from the weekend, Noah, is Zachary Risache had 36 points for the Hawks on Sunday.
Speaking of Twitter, come on now. Let them hear it. Let them hear it, Hawks fans. Come on.
Yeah, they are. Anytime Risache does something positive, my mentions are, any update? Got an update? Do you regret saying that he's a bust? I mean, look, okay. When I said he was a bust, or no, I didn't say he was a bust. When I said he was showing signs of being a number one pick bust,
yes.
He's shooting below 30% from three, struggling from the free throw line. My point was, hey, he's always been inconsistent as a shooter. He needs to be a guy who can shoot threes reliably in order to be worth that number one pick. And what he's been since a little bit before that, because he was in the middle of a hot streak when I said, hey, he's showing signs. he's been freaking awesome. He's been like 6'10" Klay Thompson, Noah. And what he did on Sunday was an example of that, because he scores 36 points. And on his made shots and drawn falls, he dribbled twice. He scored 36 dribbling twice on those makes. It was unbelievable. It's cuts to the rim. It's offensive boards. It's spot up threes. It's putbacks. Like, the dude was unbelievable in that game. And he's been unbelievable for a month straight now. And he had a hot stretch like this, you know, overseas in the year that he made himself worthy of being a top five pick. And I hope he sustains it, because he's freaking fun, dude. He does everything else. And if he's able to sustain the shooting, as he has as of late, shooting well over 40% from three, this is going to be a great player for a long time. And I think we saw what peak level Zachary Risacher might look like in that Sunday game over the Bucks, where the Hawks scored 145 on the Bucks. Talk about dead teams. But Risacher, he looked awesome, dude.
Yeah.
So no, I do regret it. I do regret it. Yes, I regret it. To answer your question,
good.
Hawks fans.
All right, good.
I do regret it. That.
You see, but this, again, this is why you're respectable, because you're willing to admit a mistake. And here's my thing on this past year's draft. I think there was so much talk going in about how weak the draft was in the front, and how there was a lack of depth, and there weren't going to be a lot of immediate impact guys and things like that. With that, Risacher goes number one, and Sarr goes number two. And in a normal year, number one and number two picks are under just immense scrutiny. They are under immense pressure. And I think because of the narrative surrounding this past June's draft, there's not as much pressure on this kid. I don't think a lot of people are looking at him to be this guy right away. They're saying, well, all right, maybe. Let's see. You know, people have told us that if it was a different year, he might have been the eighth overall pick. And that comes with a different level of circumstances. And Sarr was maybe top 10. And I heard things like that. And so when you have that as your narrative surrounding you and following you for the season, you can play a lot more free. And I think that's what we've seen from Risacher as the season's gone on, is he's playing real free. And to your point, he's shooting the ball exceptionally well. I think 38% the last 10 games from three. That's a big deal at his size and his length. And I just got to see Sarr this weekend in Washington. He's good too. He's got length. He's got defensive instincts that are really impressive. He's shooting it a lot better from three. And his previous, before the game on Saturday, I think it was his previous 10 to 12 games, he was shooting 40% from three. So you couple those two together with what their skill sets can provide, and I'm real excited for the future of both of those young men on top of what Stephon Castle has done. And obviously Dalton Connect, I think a lot of people expected, would be the steal that he's become. And we mentioned Edie, and Klingon has played well at times in Portland. It could go on what this draft has actually provided, but I think that it was probably undervalued, which is normally what happens, and not always. Sometimes a lot of people will say that a draft is weak, and then Anthony Bennett goes number one overall and somewhat proves that to be correct. But I think other times you have to wait and see, and this was a good example and probably reminder of patience being important. And so for Risacher and for Sarr and for all these guys, I'm just happy to see them succeeding at the level that they are so far today. And it's funny to see people say, wow, it's crazy. The number one overall pick might be the best player in this draft after all. You know, it just, maybe they got it right. And so credit to the Hawks for being willing to take them.
Yeah, they might have gotten right. We'll see how it pans out over the course of time. The interesting thing to me is I had Ben Taylor Thinking Basketball on my pod on Friday, and I asked him about Dort. Like, should Dort be in greater consideration for Defensive Player of the Year? He's not the favorite right now. There's no clear favorite. And I think it's the same question with Rookie of the Year, because Castle on BetMGM is the heavy favorite. He's minus 700. I mean, that's the clear heavy favorite. Sarr is plus 750. And then Risacher is also plus 750. I'm a little bit surprised Risacher hasn't closed that gap because of how great he's been. I understand Castle's probably going to win. I'm probably going to vote Castle as well. But Risacher keeps on moving up, and he might end up stealing it in the closing weeks for me. So for Hawks fans, that's just something to keep in mind with the way Risacher's performed as well. We're going to take a quick break, and when we're back, we're going to talk about March Madness. March Madness, we just watched a Sweet 16 in the Elite Eight this weekend. First thing, on my mind from these games is Walter Clayton Jr. from Florida. Yep. Clutch again. He had 30 points against Texas Tech in the final 5 minutes of that game. They're down 9. He hits a driving layup. Minute later, they're down 3. Hits a pull-up three-pointer to tie it. And then down 2 points with 1 minute left. He hits this three-pointer that looks like something only Stephen Curry can do, dribbling straight away from the basket at the top of the three-point arc, turns and fires, drains a three. And I'm like, am I a dummy for having this guy ranked in the 50s? I know he stinks on defense. I know he makes some poor decisions. I know he's not a great passer. But the dude, over and over and over again, hits these crazy clutch shots that so few people have the balls to take and the skills to make. He did it against UConn in the round of 32. The final 5 minutes, he's hitting mid-range, pull-up, sidestep, threes, a fadeaway three-pointer off balance to clinch the game and ice it for Florida. Like, how many times is this guy going to do it? I expect him to do it again in the final four.
Well, I think you nailed it. He willed them to victory against UConn, and then he willed them to victory again in the Elite Eight. And the Elite Eight, obviously, was a comeback, crazy finish effort by that Florida team. And they are a really good team. Let's start there. They are a balanced team. They've got seniors. They've got experience. They are very well coached. That goes without saying. And really, for all four of these one seeds that have made it to the Final Four, I think you can say the same for the majority of them, certainly in terms of being well coached and being balanced. But this Florida team without Walter Clayton is nowhere, as far as I'm concerned. They're out in the round of 32 against the two-time defending champions, because UConn had them on the ropes. UConn very much had that game won, in my opinion. Watching that game, the final 3 minutes, I'm saying this is UConn's game to lose until Walter Clayton happens. And I think you said it right. It just, most players wouldn't have the wherewithal and the willingness to take these shots, let alone make these shots. But he's so confident in his own abilities that he's going to go out there and he's just going to let it rip. And I think that's what makes him special. You know, you've got to give guys credit for being willing to be there in the big moments time and time and time and time again. And so as I've looked at draft boards really through the season, he's been the one guy that I was most curious about, because this is what he's done all year for this team. He's been an emotional and physical leader for this team. And anybody that can start and at some point play their collegiate career with Rick Pitino as the best player on a Rick Pitino coach team, which he did at Iona, and lead that team to the tournament, lead that team to a conference championship, that's a big deal to me, because Rick Pitino is as demanding as it gets. It means that you are mentally tough. And if you're as mentally tough as Rick Pitino needs you to be in the big moments, you generally are going to handle big moments for the rest of your life. And we're seeing, I think, the fruits of that labor now. That's what, at least from watching it and seeing it and talking to people who have spoken to him about it, I think he really points to that as being the turning point for him. He said he lost a ton of weight the first year playing for Rick. He didn't realize what it was going to require. And now it's led him to this persona on the court where the biggest moment comes and he is going to step to the forefront in that spotlight. It's been awesome to watch. He's been, to me, one of the heroes of March, if not number one on that list.
Is he the anti-RJ Lewis?
Come on, man. Too soon.
Three of 17 in the round of 32, and then he deletes his social media and transfers. I mean,
it's not great. It's not great. I would say that Walter, well, let's put it this way. Walter's handled himself a lot better, and I am very curious, especially if he plays well now in the Final Four, which I expect him to. Where does he look now on the mock drafts once the tournament's over? Because I've seen some mock drafts that have had him late first round. I've seen others that have kept him mid-second round. But he's probably one of the biggest risers over the last 3 weeks, and rightfully so. He's deserved that with his play.
Yeah, I think he's absolutely one of the biggest risers. I got my big board updated over at Yahoo Sports in our NBA draft guide, so you can see all the new rankings over there. Kaman Malawach, the Duke center, is another guy that I've inched up slightly, just one spot. I already had him in my top five. I moved him up to number four, and I wouldn't rule him out ending up at number three at one point. And the reason why, Noah, is pretty simple. There's a high floor for Malawach, as we saw it in the entire tournament. The way he's a deterrent around the rim, he's improved as a guy who's an enforcer around the basket, blocking shots, altering shots, and he's doing it over more minutes. He played 31 minutes against that high-powered Alabama offense. He was, in my opinion, the key reason why they held Bama to only 65 points. It's the second lowest score of the season for Bama this year. They had 64 in a game earlier this season. Duke was dominant defensively because of Malawach, but also because Malawach's offense, like, we know what he can do. He's a lob finisher. He's shooting 87% from the floor in the tournament. He dunks everything around the rim that's thrown to him. He has good hands. But the touch, he hit a right-handed hook shot and a left-handed hook shot at the end of the Sweet 16 game. Gavoni from Draft Express is posting a video of him taking step-back threes and workouts before the game. I think there's more to Malawach to uncover in the years to come. And right now we're seeing the floor, and it's very high for him. But I think the ceiling could be a little bit higher than people think with his skill level and the rate of improvement that we've seen this year at Duke as well.
Yeah, so Kevin, I saw him actually before he got to Duke this year at the Olympics. He was playing with South Sudan. And there were players that obviously produced a lot more for South Sudan. Carleek Jones was very important for them. Wenyen Gabriel had a great tournament. JT Thor, things like that. They did have legit NBA talent. And they had legit collegiate stars or previous collegiate stars. But he was the guy that when I walked away from the game, I said, I need to find out more about this dude. And I had obviously done research before the game and knew he was going to Duke, knew how young he was going into that tournament. He's been more and more impressive as the season's gone on. And this is exactly kind of what I expected from him, was to learn as the year grew. And I feel like his game has grown with the season. And that makes a lot of sense, obviously, with the experience that he's gotten in a major conference and now playing in these NCAA tournament games. It feels like he's been prepared and he's been properly preparing himself. But what stood out to me was the raw ability to move his feet, to be in the right place at the right time defensively. And then to your point, the touch is there. He took some jump shots in the Olympic Games where I said, oh, that's going to be a good shot eventually for him as he keeps working on it. You can see the makings and the build of what it's going to look like long term for him as he continues to develop into his NBA career. But I'm with you. I think that this guy has as much upside as anybody in the draft. The floor thing is interesting because I don't know what his floor currently is at the NBA level. I think he still needs to do a couple more things to get to a point where I'm saying he's an everyday starting center in the NBA, but I don't think that it's far off. I think it's coming very quickly for him because you can see what the work looks like. And you, to your point, the touch is there, the raw ability is there. So now if he's continuing to learn the game in a proper way, I think the sky's the limit, especially if he ends up in a good situation with an excellent coaching staff. That's where you really believe that this guy can be special.
Who would you rather have if you're starting a franchise? Kaman Malawach or Derek Queen?
Oh, it's hard because I think you look at the defensive instincts of Malawach and say that he's clearly ahead of Queen there. But offensively, Queen is a problem. And I got to see Maryland at the end of the year, this year, the end of the regular season. He didn't even play well. And what stands out to me about him and how he can impact the game on the offensive end is he is such a great player that he doesn't even need to go out there and shoot the ball exceptionally well to then go out and have 15 points. He can get himself to the free throw line. He doesn't need others to initiate his offense for him. And so he's so advanced on the offensive end. However, he's 20 years old. He's an old freshman. You know, there's a Kylan Boswell on Illinois, is a junior in college, and is about 6 months younger than Derek Queen, who's just finishing up his true freshman season. And Malawach is more similar to Boswell. So if you're saying based on just sheer potential, it would be hard to pass up Malawach. But if you're somebody that's saying, hey, we need someone to help us right now, it's easily Derek Queen.
I think that's a fair take there because Derek Queen, the scoring, it's going to translate right away with what he can do. And Malawach, he's still, you know, it's always an adjustment for young players to get to the NBA level with the physicality and the size that Malawach will be facing in a night-in, night-out basis. So that's always an adjustment. Let's talk about Danny Wolfe from Michigan. Danny Wolfe, very divisive prospect. He's a love him or hate him guy. He's a junior transfer. He went to Yale his first few years in college, then transferred to Michigan. This past season, shot 33% from three, 59% from the free throw line. Not great numbers on the surface, but then you're like, oh, wait a minute. He's a 7-foot point guard, and he makes behind-the-back passes, and he can take step-back threes. And we saw a lot of that in the Sweet 16 against Auburn. Michigan lost that game by 13 points. But throughout the tournament, we saw the flashes from Danny Wolf. We also saw the lows. He shot only 33% from three. He made only 25% of his free throws in the tournament as well. Where are you at with Danny Wolf, Noah? Are you in the love him or hate him camp or somewhere in between?
Probably more skewing towards the love him camp than I would be on the hate him side. I did many Michigan games this year, and I remember the first one was early in the season. And this was, again, he was still relatively unknown to major college basketball at this point. He had obviously been a really big factor on a tournament team at Yale last season. And so I think the people around college basketball knew of him, but they didn't quite understand just how good he could be. And I think he still has another gear that he has. He's got untapped potential in there. But the shooting ability at his size, that'll come. I think it'll continue to get better and more consistent. But it's the fact that he's comfortable taking a step back three and making it in a big moment. He's comfortable shooting off the bounce at his size. That's just not common for a 7-footer. And then running pick and roll, I don't remember a 7-footer with as much feel as him, unless you want to count Kevin Durant as a 7-footer, which you easily could. But the way that he sees the floor and the way that Michigan would run their big pick and roll with Wolf at the controls and Vlad Goldin going to set the screen at 7'1", that was nearly impossible to guard. So many teams struggled with that. Wisconsin came in expecting to be an elite defense this year. They carved them down the stretch. I think there were six straight possessions where Wisconsin just had no answers. They could not get a singular bucket to get off the board because Michigan just continued to go inside and Wolf continued to make the right play, whether that was for himself with a nice little floater in the lane, whether that was to get it to Goldin, his running mate inside. So I'm a big fan. I think that he's got ability defensively. He could struggle a little bit, certainly at the NBA level, but offensively, you know what he could potentially be capable of. And so it's a very willing flyer that I would take if I was a team in the 20s in the draft. I think that that's where, if you're looking for somebody who could potentially move the needle and you don't know exactly what it's going to be long term, that's the guy I'm looking at, because I think the upside way outweighs the potential negatives that he brings.
I think that's fair with him. I mean, look, I'm pretty split on him. I have major concerns about the shooting touch. The numbers at Yale weren't great for him as a shooter from the line or from the field. They weren't great at Michigan this year. In his three-year career, he's made only 64.6% of his free throws, only 33.6% of his three-pointers. And, you know, it's not great off the catch, not great off the dribble when it comes to the results. But as you said, if you're betting on his ability to create the playmaking feel and the versatility that he could bring in a 7-foot frame, like maybe he does figure it out as a shooter at some point. Maybe there's something small mechanical in his hands that the right coach can fix. And he shows the ability to create. He has something unteachable. And in the 20s, I mean, sure, why the hell not with betting on that type of upside? I don't see why you wouldn't in that range, 20s or 30s. The teens, I have some issues there. There's a lot of guys that I think I'd prefer similar upside swings in the 20s. But Danny Wolf, one of the players that makes this draft class interesting, I think. I mean, you know this from doing games this year. I think this draft class has a lot of guys that are just intriguing, like just weird, funky players.
The other thing with Wolf, before we move on past him, I also think that he's an underrated cutter. That's just one thing that he could do in the NBA right away. He's got a really good feel off the ball, as well as being as proficient as he is on the ball. And so that's, again, it just if you're putting everything kind of in a recipe and mixing it together, to me, you still get more positive than negative, but you're really going to have to teach out a lot of the negative, if you will. And then you're going to have to try to get him in the right position defensively, which I think will be a process. But I just, to your point, the upside is there. The creation is there. And you just don't see a lot of players quite like this. And so to me, it's always going to be a willing flyer to take, especially if you're a team like Brooklyn that's got four first round picks anyway, and you're just going to compile these young pieces. you already know you're going to get a blue chip type guy in the top five potentially. So why not go and take a risk and see if it pays off for you? I that's where I see potentially a team saying, hey, we've got a number of picks anyway. Let's see if this kid can potentially pan out the way we think he might. And the free throw thing, I really believe was mental for him. Having talked to him, having watched him up close, big moments, he would get to the line. He was as frustrated with himself as any player I've seen. And so I think that can also be taught a little bit more long term if he can get out of his own head.
That's always scary. The mental aspect of the line, because sometimes you're free and you're feeling good when you're shooting from the floor, but at the line, it's just you. Just you in a full loud crowd arena. So hopefully he's able to figure that out. But I want Danny Wolf to be good. A 7-foot pasty white dude who can shoot threes and big play. I mean, the white guy's back in the NBA, Noah.
I mean, listen, it's definitely going to be quite the headline in this draft. I can tell you that much. Cooper Flagg obviously going to go number one. Con Knipples having just a sensational tournament for himself. Danny Wolf, I think, really showcasing his skill. So we're gonna see what this looks like moving forward here. But yeah, I'll be curious on Wolf. I really am rooting for him because he was a great kid to talk to and very passionate.
We'll take one more quick break and we'll be back talking about the Final Four and some mailbag questions y'all sent in. Final Four this year is all one seeds for the first time since 2008. Did you get your bracket correct, your Final Four, or did you have some other inclusions here?
No, I. What was funny is I remember texting multiple people the second that my bracket was done, and I said, this is either going to be the best bracket I've ever created or the worst, and I think it's the worst. I decided on a number of upsets. I just said, you know what, I'm going to go against the grain this year. Now, my Final Four, for the most part, was still fairly strong in theory because I have Duke as a champion. I've just felt that they've been too strong all season. But I had St. John's there, like many people did. That did not go well. I had Michigan State there, which nearly did happen. They were right there. And then I had one surprise because I always like to find a surprise of some kind. And I had Gonzaga as that surprise. And they also were awfully close to beating Houston in that second round. So I didn't feel terrible about the picks, but this was the one year that you have the person that you generally make fun of for saying, oh, my God, you chose all one seeds? What are you doing? You usually say, you don't know anything about the tournament. Well, now they finally can strike back, quite like Luke Skywalker. So I don't know. How was your bracket?
I mean, I only had two of the Final Four. I had Duke and Houston in there. My mistakes were I had Michigan State and I had Texas Tech in there. Close, but not quite there. So I did not work that out. That's fine. It's okay. I'm happy we get all these one seeds. It's pretty amazing. The top four net ratings, according to Ken Palm this year, have been four dominant teams this year. So now we get to see them face off starting on Saturday with the Final Four and then Monday in San Antonio. So I'm excited for that. And Jahni Broome, man, the moment he had on Sunday for Auburn, he goes out, he says, I'm done. When he's leaving towards the locker room and he comes back, he gets his Willis Reed moment. That was pretty cool.
That was awesome. The funniest part, I think, was afterward as Tracy Wilson is interviewing Bruce Pearl and he, per usual, gets the whole team behind him. It's like Nick Gallo and the Thunder, but at the college level, it's great. But Tracy Wilson goes, oh, and the Willis Reed moment. And Bruce Pearl's like, yeah, 100%. You could look at Jahni, and I don't think he had any idea what that meant. I think he has no clue what a Willis Reed moment means, you know, what that is. And so, but it 100% was exactly that, where he comes out of the locker room, and yeah, he hits the three, but outside of that, he doesn't do a whole lot. He's trying to grab rebounds one-handed, essentially. And most important, whether or not he's going to be healthy for the Final Four is at the forefront, I think, of every Auburn fan's mind right now. But what it did, as the team did keep this, essentially the same cushion, I think maybe they were outscored by one at one point with him going out and then came back in. What it did was provide energy for them to run through the tape and emotionally. And I think that was just his presence was important. That's what he does more than anything, is he's a calming presence for that team, because I don't think that he's the most skilled player in the world. I think obviously he is an elite college basketball player. He's one of those guys that just understands the game. He understands how to take advantage of angles incredibly well. He was shooting the ball really exceptionally against Michigan State. He started out just at a ridiculous level, and he hit a couple threes. And when he does that, that's when he becomes really dangerous, because you can't entirely double him. He's a good enough passer. But I don't think he's one of these guys that you just say he is this immense talent. He's got all this raw ability. I think it's his passion. I think it's his energy. I think it's his will to win. That's what drags his team over the finish line, and it did it again against the Spartans.
Mailbag question from Juan. He asks, who are the non-tournament players who may be undervalued since they aren't in the spotlight? Noah, you can go first here. Who's a non-tournament player that fans should know about?
Yeah, I think that now in the modern game, it's so different, because in the past, let's say, you have all these teams that maybe didn't make the tournament that have guys on lower levels that had been there for 4 years and just never quite got their moment. But now with the transfer portal, I think you see all these guys move from school to school. And so even if you started at a mid-major or a JUCO or something, you can become Walter Clayton Jr. And have your moment. You can become Jahni Broome and be the potential player of the year in college basketball. That just wasn't the case even 5-10 years ago. So it's a little different, because I think we get to see a lot more players now. I'll go with guys who – I'm going to go twofold. I'm going to say one would be a guy who's not coming back, and it's not even a guy who's under the radar, because he plays in a major program and he led the nation in scoring, and that would be Eric Dixon. And the reason that I would say Eric Dixon would be someone who I still would take a second-round pick to draft – is I look at what Eric Paschal did after Villanova, and he had a couple real solid years in the NBA. I think that Dixon's a bigger, better version of him. And I'm big on, how did you improve? If you stayed in college 4 years, how did you improve from year to year to year? Eric Dixon was a guy who didn't even take a three-pointer, essentially, when he first got to college. And he was on a really good Villanova team that went to the Final Four, was a good part of that team as a young player in college in 2022. But the way he's developed to the point that he is an assassin from three-point range, one of the leaders in three-point percentage in all of college basketball this year, he can get it done off the dribble. And his frame is such that he's big and strong that he can then bully you in the post. So I'm just curious what he looks like. I think similarly to what we talked about before with guys like Derek Queen and Danny Wolfe, he'll have to learn defensively in the NBA how to be in the right spot at the right time and think the game a little bit more. But his offense is there. So that's one guy that I would look at. And then the other way I would look at this is, who's going to be big next season in college basketball, potentially in the transfer portal? And Bryce Hopkins is the name that stands out to me. He was at Providence. He started at Kentucky. Elite prospect coming into college. And you saw the makings of him being an elite college player as well. 2 years ago at Providence, he was probably the front runner for Big East Player of the Year, which his teammate eventually got at Providence, but it was because he tore his ACL that he wasn't in consideration at the very end of the season. He was essentially averaging a double-double. He is a monster, and if he's healthy, he only played in three games this year, and he's now in the transfer portal, and we'll see if St. John's truly can grab him, which is a lot of what the rumor mill would tell you. He's a problem on the court, and he's a guy that I would look at moving forward, not just this year, but then past, because I do think that still in the draft, as I look at the NBA draft, you say, okay, first 15 or so picks are going to be the young players. They still are. The top 10 are essentially all freshmen in college or international players, and even really the top 15 probably still stretches to that. But in the second half of the first round and then into the second round, I do think that teams are a little bit more willing now to look at those 4 or 5 year players because of the way that they've improved. And I just remember from my time with the Clippers, my first year there, they drafted Terrence Mann 48th overall. And Terrence Mann, he was in college the same 4 years I was in college in the ACC. I was at Syracuse. He was at Florida State. And every single game, I remember saying, wow, that guy just makes winning plays. He just makes winning plays. He just does all the right things. And he got incrementally better from freshman to sophomore to junior to senior year. And so here comes the draft. First of all, he doesn't even get invited initially to the combine, which is crazy to me. So he goes to the G League Elite Camp, and he plays so well that he gets the last invitation to the Combine. He performs well at the Combine, and still nobody in the first round is even sniffing him. He had to get drafted because Jerry West essentially said, this kid has a chance to be an NBA player. And I look at him now, and he's a legitimate rotation player in the NBA for now. This is his seventh or sixth year in the NBA, his sixth year. And so, and he was a major factor on a team that went to the Western Conference Finals. And he's been a bit major factor in Atlanta playing well and putting themselves in position to be a playoff team this year. And so I just look at guys like Bryce Hopkins moving forward. If he has a big year, I think it's similar where a team's going to say, hey, look, played a lot of basketball. It's the same with a guy like Jahni Broome or Dixon, as I mentioned. These guys have played in big moments. They understand what it means to play in a difficult atmosphere where everybody's against you or where things maybe haven't gone your way. They've learned a lot more about their life and about themselves. And they're still only 22, 23 years old. And I go back to Ivica Zubac, who at 28 has taken this massive leap, or Norman Powell, who at 30, 31 has become a fringe all-star. It's very possible. And so I think teams are starting to recognize that a little bit more. And that's why I would look at some of those guys like Hopkins to make that leap next year.
Those are both great selections. Dixon, for sure, Noah. I like that one a lot. And then with Hopkins, he's just kind of disappeared, you know, with the injuries ever since that sophomore season for him at Providence. And if he goes to St. John's and replaces RJ Lewis and gets those minutes, like, he could very well win Big East Player of the Year next season. Like, he could have that type of season for them. But I'm a fan of both of those selections. I would go with someone out west at Stanford, Maxime Reynaud, 7'1" center. This past year, he shot 34.7% on 5.5 threes per game, grabbed 10.6 rebounds, blocked almost two shots per game. Reynaud is somebody who I got a comparison to Brook Lopez for him in the draft guide. It's like, you know, a generic response, a big who shoots threes. But with him, there's a little bit more he does off the dribble as well that is really intriguing to me, with his passing and feel he shows as well. Some quick touch passes. He makes quick, you know, passes with velocity out to the perimeter as well. I think there's more skill to him that could really develop in the NBA in the years to come, because he also was another guy that's gotten better each year in college, now as a senior for Stanford. So, you know, Brook Lopez, probably the best in that archetype for like a 7-foot guy who can protect the rim with sheer size and shoot threes. But for that archetype, give me Reynaud developing into that for a team in the mid-late first round. I currently have him going to the Celtics in my mock draft at number 28. Like, to me, that's a perfect situation for him. But as you said earlier in regards to the Nets, there's a lot of teams this year that have multiple first-round picks. So I'd expect we're going to see some teams try to go safe, quote-unquote safe, with one pick and then take a big swing with another pick. And Reynaud is one of those guys as well that fits that category.
Yeah, the shout out to the Stanford boys too. So I always love this, where Brooke and Robin Lopez obviously played high school growing up, all that stuff together into college. And I always try to picture, because I don't think that they went to this, you know, powerhouse school necessarily in high school. Could you imagine failing your algebra or like geometry exam? Being like, all right, well, at least I have a basketball game to get all my frustrations out on the court. And then you walk up to the court and you look to the other side and you have 2 7-foot monsters. You're like, come on, bro. Or like when Zion was in college playing against just the random kids and they had a terrible day at school. And it's like, all right, well, I got a game. And then Zion's doing a 360 windmill on their head. That's just got to be brutal, man.
Gotta be horrible. I cannot imagine. I'd want to go back home. Wouldn't want to play. Next mailbag question. Yeah, I know. Next mailbag question here from Philip. Philip C. writes this email. He says, in almost every game I see SGA play, I see Michael Jordan. He writes, his clutchness, his handle, his mid-range. SGA is smaller and thus not quite as physically dominant, but the game is very similar. He's also a good-looking guy who models underwear. Why isn't anyone talking about this? Philip writes. Why is nobody talking about it, Noah?
Well, everybody's talking about the underwear thing. I think that goes without saying. That's gotten a lot of traction over the last 12 months or so. No, it's an interesting point, and I go back to Kawhi Leonard having that crazy run with Toronto and Doc Rivers calling him Michael Jordan, everybody freaking out. But if you really take the step back and think about it, it does make a little bit of sense, especially for Kawhi. I think that the similarities are very much there in the hand size and the way that they play in the mid-range. And the mid-range is, for the Shea aspect, is where I would look, because he's so proficient in getting to his spots and he doesn't need a lot of airspace, similar to what Michael did. on the offensive end. So I look at Shea and I say, okay, dude, if you can go out there and continue to dominate in the mid-range like you have essentially your entire career, and especially since he's become a go-to guy for this team, he has been every bit of playing at his pace. And Mike was a lot more of go out there, brute force, especially early in his career, athleticism, get to the rim. But as his career developed, and I think that's where more of the comparison would come, he just became a lot smarter about thinking the game. And Shea is really good about thinking about his spots and anticipating where things are going to open up before they do, and then playing whatever pace he wants to play. He is, and I get frustrated when I see the foul baiter stuff on Twitter, and really with a lot of players, because, and I know Shea's dad was talking about this recently, about that being a skill, and that's partially true. But more for him, I just think it takes away from how good he actually is in getting to his spots, in finishing through contact, in finding ways to get angles and finding ways to get shots off over length. He's just so good and nearly unguardable. He's having one of the most efficient seasons we've ever seen in NBA history. And I think that deserves praise more than any blowback. And so the Michael comparisons are probably a little bit much, but at the same time, I think he does deserve a ton of respect for the way he's handled himself since becoming a bona fide number one.
I mean, you don't become Michael Jordan until you do it in the postseason. Simple as that.
No doubt.
No, you don't become MJ until you get it done then. Question from Jared. Last thing here for us, Noah. Jared asks, can our Syracuse Orange get back to a place in the elite of college basketball, or are we doomed to be a relic of the pre-NIL era?
Listen, anything is possible in this current landscape of college basketball. I think that you look at teams that improve year to year. Obviously, St. John's is just the most glaring example from this year of what Rick Pitino has done within 2 years because of NIL. And I think that it's about accepting and also going all in. You know, Steph Curry is a great example of understanding, hey, Davidson can go out there and compete every year and get into the potentially the NCAA tournament if I go and give my time and resources to that program. Awesome. Let me go do that. And I know that Syracuse has people that are willing to do that and willing to help. And obviously Carmelo Anthony is very connected with the program, and his son is now going to be a freshman with the program next year. And so I know he's out there and he's willing to help. It's going to require a lot of that. And any of these schools outside of those that are already getting big time money, a lot of them being in the SEC, which is why they got 14 teams into the NCAA tournament this year, and then a lot of the others being in the Big Ten, which is why they got a ton of their teams into the tournament this year. It's going to require resources, time, and making sure that you are staying on top of it year to year. Alex Klein, their GM, he has a lot of NBA experience. He's been in a couple front offices. He knows how the pro game works. But this is not NBA pro game. And I think, I know Alex knows this well. And Rick Pitino said this really beautifully, I thought, at the end of the year. This is like European basketball. This is like going overseas, where it's 1 to 2 year contracts if you play for Real Madrid or if you go and play in Turkey for one of those elite programs. It's not getting a 5 year max contract. And so if you handle it that way, where you're saying, hey, we're getting a guy for 1 to 2 years, we need to reload this position here. And there's a reason that Rick Pitino said he's not taking any high school kids next year, because he doesn't need that. Now, Syracuse is a little different, where they're essentially trying to build their nucleus, so now they can replenish year to year to year. It's going to take a little time, and the hope is that they take that major step forward next year, which I think they're capable of doing with a talent that they're going to have on their team. But it's a make-or-break year for Adrian Autry, and Adrian Autry is as great of a guy as you're going to find, and he knows how to coach basketball, so he has to go out there and prove it, and that team's going to have to take a step towards at least making the tournament next season for that to be deemed a success.
Well, I'm rooting for that, Noah. I like when Syracuse is good. I like when they're good.
Yeah.
And they're a fun team when they're good. The orange jerseys are cool. Obviously, for years running their zone defense, I just always liked how different they were. I hope your Syracuse Orange are able to get back. Noah, this is fun, man. This is our first pod together. We've been friends for a long time. It's been cool to do this pod with you. Thank you for coming on, man.
hopefully first of many. I appreciate you having me. And yeah, I still feel happier with all the colors. So I appreciate you putting me in a good mood for the rest of the day.
Appreciate it, man. Got a lot more coming this week with the Final Four, final stretch of the NBA games. Appreciate you joining me.
Absolutely.
Big thank you to Noah Eagle for joining me on today's episode. Subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show if you've not done so already. Big thanks to Mike, Emmy, and TJ for producing it. We'll be back again later in the week talking about more basketball, college, NBA. It's all coming. Have a good day.